Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Abby Williams, Vice President of the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I would like to welcome you to the Institute and to thank you very much for your interest in the subject of today's public event, Russia and the West. The Russia-Georgia conflict has had traumatic impact on the region and has raised new concerns about Russia's role in the world. And Russia's recognition of the Georgian separatist territories of South Ossetia and Abkhazia has also reopened a debate about between Russia and the West over the meaning of sovereignty and the meaning of independence. Some analysts have argued that Russia's main goal is to have a more assertive policy in its neighborhood and to limit further NATO expansion. Still, some others believe that a new Cold War is underway, but are historical analogies, especially to the Cold War, really accurate? What are the long-term consequences and wider implications for peace and stability in the Caucasus? How will Russia's relations with its neighbors evolve? What are the long-term implications of what happened recently in Georgia for U.S.-Russia relations? And similarly, what are the long-term implications for Russia's relations with the European Union and with NATO? We're fortunate to have four outstanding panelists who will examine these important issues this morning. Because their biographies have been distributed to you, I will introduce them very briefly in the order in which they will speak. Hope Harrison is Associate Professor of History and International Affairs and Director of the Institute for European, Russian, Eurasian Studies at George Washington University. She served on the National Security Council in the Clinton and Bush administrations as Director for European and Eurasian Affairs. Her book, Driving the Soviets Up the Wall, the Soviet-East-German Relations 1953-1961, won the 2004 Marshall Schulman Prize from the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies. Hope will speak on U.S.-Russian relations. Chantal de Jong-Udrat is my colleague here at the Institute. She's Associate Vice President of the Jennings Randall Fellowship Program. Prior to joining USIP, she was a Senior Fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. She's also served as a member of the directing staff at the UN Institute for Disarmament Research in Geneva. Chantal is a member of Women in International Security, WISE, and served as its vice president from 2001 to 2007. And Chantal will address the topic of Russia's relations with NATO and the EU. Vladislav Zubok is Associate Professor of History at Temple University. He was born and educated in Russia and received his doctorate at the Institute for U.S. and Canada Studies, Academy of Science in Moscow. He has published several books, including the prize-winning Inside the Kremlin's Cold War, From Stalin to Khrushchev. From 1999 to 2001, he was director of the project Cold War in South Caucasus at the National Security Archives. Vladislav will provide a Russian perspective on all these crucial issues.
Not necessarily Russian, my own.
Ah, will provide his own perspective on all these critical...
Transnational perspective.
A transnational perspective on all these critical issues. But I do hope we will not ignore the Russian perspective in this discussion. Nick Vozdev is Professor of National Security Studies at the Naval War College and a senior editor at the National Interest. He was a senior fellow at the Nixon Center and has taught at Georgetown University, his alma mater, and George Washington University. He's the author of six books, including imperial policy and perspectives towards Georgia 1762 to 1819. He received his doctorate from Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. And Nick, as discussant, will react to the presentations and begin what I am confident will be a lively discussion. I'm going to ask each of them to limit their opening remarks to 15 minutes. Then I'll open the floor to all of you. You came here to be active participants in this event, and we welcome it. And when you're recognized and you take the floor, I hope you'll come to one of the two microphones, give us your name and affiliation. Again, thank you very much for being here, and I would ask Hope Harrison to start.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and see some new and old friends and be reunited with Abby and the three panelists who are also friends. So this is very nice. In this tense environment in U.S.-Russia relations, at least we all on the panel have very friendly relations. My comments today will be not just on U.S.-Russia relations. They'll be also on U.S.-Georgia relations, which is essential, I think, to understanding what's been going on, and particularly the events of August. My remarks today are based on my background as a scholar of international affairs and also the time I spent at the White House at the NSC in 2000 and 2001. I'm going to talk about the triangular relationship between the U.S., Georgia, and Russia, because I think it's only by understanding that that one can really understand what's happened over the past month and a half. When I got to the White House in the fall of 2000, I was surprised to see very quickly how important the Republic of Georgia was to the U.S. government and to the president himself, Clinton at the time, and this would continue under President Bush. Now, I came to the White House having just completed a book, as Abby mentioned, Driving the Soviets Up the Wall, that examined the relationship between a major power and a smaller power, where the smaller power was sometimes able to manipulate the larger power. My argument in that book is that the Soviets had not wanted to build the Berlin Wall, had in fact resisted that for 8 years while the East Germans kept pushing and pushing for that. So that was on my mind when I joined the staff at the White House. And as soon as I started having interactions with Georgian officials, which I did very frequently, I was reminded of that relationship between a small ally and sort of a strategically important place and a larger ally farther away, where the smaller ally, in this case Georgia, often seemed to feel that they could pick up the phone and get whatever they needed from the U.S. government. I started asking around why was this the case, because I was surprised to see it, and quickly found out that it was because of the role of then-President Edward Shevardnadze of Georgia in ending the Cold War. He and Gorbachev, of course, played the crucial role in 1989, 90, and 91, together with President Bush 41 and others, and that really solidified ties when Shevardnadze left as foreign minister of the Soviet Union and ultimately became president of the new independent Republic of Georgia. He started off with very strong friends in the White House because of his role at the end of the Cold War. There was much gratitude for the role he had played in that, and it was clear that the White House really treated Georgia differently and in a very special way compared to other former Soviet republics and even many other countries. Now, there were, under Clinton and Bush, constant concerns in the White House about the growing corruption of Shevardnadze's regime, and this became increasingly vocal. It wasn't just a case of us always saying, you know, we're there for you and we're supporting your democracy and we're supporting you against Russia. There was also a realistic sense that there were some problems with Georgian democracy, as there still are. But still, we treated Georgia under Shevardnadze and then Saakashvili after the Rose Revolution in a special way. And this all was very much accentuated every time, which was fairly frequent, that the Russian government put pressure on Georgia, whether it was militarily at the border or economically or, of course, politically. The White House was always eager to help bolster Georgia. In particular, Russia was very concerned that Chechen fighters were crossing the border into Georgia through the Pankisi Gorge. The Georgians didn't have the forces to keep that border as secure and closed as it needed to be. And the U.S. government has played an important role in helping to train and equip Georgian forces and bolster that border. The Russians, of course, had mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, they definitely wanted that border closed and stopped Chechen rebels from escaping into Georgia. But on the other hand, growing U.S. influence, in particular military aid to Georgia, is certainly something that Putin has long been very concerned about, and which I heard personally the frustration and anger in his voice on the subject of Georgia more than once. So when the Bush team came in 2001, they continued this policy of a very special place for Georgia, particularly because his father had had such close ties with Shevardnadze, but also with the new sort of freedom agenda of the Bush administration. First Shevardnadze, but particularly Saakashvili, have really sort of jumped into that. And if you read the recent op-ed by President Saakashvili in the Washington Post, talking about how we have to stand up to Russian aggression, but saying that Georgia is sort of a symbol of the West and the values of the West, and he keeps painting things in as stark terms as possible, in part very significantly to get as much support from this administration as possible. So the two key effects of this growing dynamic and the close ties between Georgia and the U.S. have been, on the one hand, increasing Georgian confidence that they could ask the U.S. for more political, economic, and military aid, and sometimes try to get the U.S. to solve their problems, including with Russia, instead of always trying as hard as they could to deal with some issues without us. And the second effect, of course, has been an increasing Russian anger, particularly on the part of Putin, at the growing ties between Georgia and the West, and, of course, particularly the discussions about Georgia getting a membership action plan in NATO. So from my time at the White House in 2000 and 2001, I unfortunately have long expected to happen something like what happened in August, namely Russia and Georgia to come to military blows over tensions between the two of them. There was many times I had been on alert over weekends when I was at the White House thinking it would happen back then. So I've been surprised that it took so long, but of course very depressed when the conflicts did break out into a military conflict. Now, you know, we've seen that people in the U.S. administration have said, you know, we kept warning Saakashvili, we told him sort of don't take on the Russian bear, you're never going to win. And I can imagine that U.S. officials were probably trying to restrain him. But after years of feeling that the U.S. was going to back up Georgia, particularly against Russia. I'm not surprised that Saakashvili may very well have thought, well, they have to say that, but when it really comes down to it, they will support me. So he, of course, has had a very rude awakening because Georgia really has lost South Ossetia and Abkhazia. No matter how much we talk about the territorial integrity of Georgia and sovereignty, those have been lost to Russia. I don't see how at all in the near future that is going to change. Now, the massive deterioration in U.S.-Russian relations because of Russia's assault on Georgia and the way the U.S. has responded has led many people to think we're in a new Cold War. Now, of course, the international system is not what it was in the Cold War, a bipolar international system. That does not exist. But what sadly has come back is incredible suspicion and lack of trust and really diametrically opposed narratives on the part of Russia and the U.S. This is very vivid in the press, both in Russia and the U.S. It's all black and white, blaming the other side, black and white often on sort of the role of Georgia in all of this. And it's really sort of highlighted a growing divergence of perceptions between the U.S. and Russia, between Russia and the West over at least the past 10 years, involving the expansion of NATO and the Russian sense that not only were they promised that NATO wouldn't expand, but they've seen that as NATO has expanded, some of the newer members have been more anti-Russian than some of the older members. And so for Russia, the expansion of NATO has made it more anti-Russian. The other very difficult thing, I think, for the U.S., well, the two challenges for the U.S. in all of this. One is that much though many people in the U.S. government have wanted to punish Russia for really crossing a red line, violating international law, you know, invading another country, there has not been a lot that we could do in the West if we wanted to punish Russia. And this has been made incredibly clear to the Russians and the rest of the world. The unintended dismal state of the U.S. Economy has had far worse effects on Russia than anything we intentionally have done. The other challenge for the U.S. in all of this in sort of lecturing Russia about how it shouldn't behave in this way is that as far as the Russians are concerned, we have no moral credibility, unfortunately, after Iraq, after Abu Ghraib, after Guantanamo, to be saying these kinds of things to them, which is why the role of Europe is so important, which Chantal will talk much more about. Something that I've been wondering as an expert on the Cold War is the question of will Russia's aggressive moves in Georgia ultimately backfire as often Soviet aggressive moves did. For example, in 1948, when the West was seeking to build up a democratic capitalist West German state 3 years after the end of World War II, Stalin responded by blockading Berlin, hoping to stop the West from creating this democratic capitalist Western state. Instead, that totally backfired because of the aggressive bellicose moves by Stalin. The West, in fact, not only went ahead with creating a West German state, but also formed the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So in the long run, Stalin's moves proved to be really backfired on him. And only time will tell whether the growing international condemnation of the Russian strategy in Georgia will completely backfire. My final remarks have to do with the question of going forward now. There has been so much hostile rhetoric on both sides that I feel that policymakers on both sides need to be, and hopefully are, going to soon come to the conclusion that this can't go on. The depth to which U.S.-Russian relations have sunk is really quite extraordinary, and I think is making some people sort of pull back from the brink and say, you know, wait a minute, we don't want to go back to the Cold War. We do have all sorts of shared interests, even if we disagree in many ways, we need to deal with each other in a constructive way. The recent meeting in Washington this week of former American and Russian ambassadors talking about the need to create a much more intensive dialogue at all levels of the American and Russian governments, which has not existed, I heartily endorse, and the sense that harsh rhetoric and mutual recriminations are not a serious policy, and we need to now move on and talk about the things we have in common. But as long as Russia does not fully abide by the terms of the ceasefire, there will only be so far that the U.S. and the West can go with Russia. And so it is very important that Russia abide by the terms and then that both governments start to reengage in a very serious way. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I hope that's a very good start. Let me turn the floor now to Chantal, who will address Russia's relations with the European Union and NATO.
Thank you, Abhi. Good morning, everybody. Actually, my remarks will focus mostly on NATO, and then I'll say a few words about EU, and maybe also the differences between US and Europe vis-à-vis the Caucasus and vis-à-vis Russia. Now, what is this Georgian conflict? What are the implications for NATO? And how do NATO members see NATO's future and NATO's mission? Is this an alliance that is about strategic reassurance in Europe, or an alliance to deal with a resurgent Russia? Or is it an alliance that has gone beyond those missions? Now, when we talk about NATO these days, it is often said that NATO's future is being played out in Afghanistan. And I think while that is true for the immediate future, one could also argue that actually NATO's long-term future has been decided upon in the Caucasus. I think in August, many NATO officials must have had huge sighs of relief that NATO's April Bucharest summit had not adopted a membership action plan for Georgia and Ukraine. I think that most, if not all, NATO member states were very happy not to have to declare that they were now all Georgians. I think the Georgian crisis has really put a stop to further NATO expansion. Or to put it a little bit more diplomatically, I think it has reinforced the reservations that some NATO member states had with respect to expansion. I think the NATO, the Georgia crisis has also brought to the fore the fundamental challenges that NATO is facing. And that is that member states have profound differences of opinion about the future tasks of the organization. Now, ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, NATO has been looking for a new mission. And I would argue that throughout most of the 1990s, there were three main schools of thought on NATO's missions and NATO's future. One school is, for lack of a better word, I would call them the pessimist. The other two are the maximalist and the minimalist. Now, the pessimists believe that with the end of the Cold War and the disappearance of the Soviet Union, NATO has lost its mission, had lost its raison d'être, and consequently they thought that NATO would disappear as well. The maximalist advocated that with the disappearance of NATO's traditional mission, NATO would have to develop new missions. Their mantra was go out of area or out of business. Finally, the minimalist argued that NATO should focus on its core missions, self-defense and strategic reassurance in Europe, and not get involved in missions and operations outside of Europe. Now, I think recently, among member states, NATO member states, the pessimist perspective or school of thought has receded into the background. And I think today within NATO, there are really two schools of thought, and that is the minimalist and the maximalist. And there are three issues that are really being debated here. First is NATO's mission. Second is NATO's membership. And third are its capabilities. Now, I would argue that most NATO's new member states are mission minimalist. They believe that NATO should focus on its core mission of collective self-defense, that is Article 5 missions. And for them, Russia really remains a very real and a very growing security concern. Among NATO member states, there is very little support for missions in places such as Afghanistan. A poll in June of this year reported that only 24% of Poles supported the deployment of NATO troops in Afghanistan, and 65% believed that these troops should be withdrawn. Now, NATO's new members are in favor of NATO expansion to other European member states, such as to other European states such as Ukraine and Georgia, but they do not believe in a global expansion of NATO membership. For instance, extending membership to countries such as Australia or New Zealand. Now, the maximalists, on the other hand, which are led by the US, the UK, Canada, and I would argue also the NATO Secretary General, believe that most of the security threats facing the transatlantic community emanate from outside of Europe, and they consequently believe that NATO has to adopt a global orientation to deal with these threats. I think for the maximalist, September 11th really sort of ended the debate over NATO's missions. For maximalists, NATO has to go out of area to deal with security challenges that migrate around a globalizing world. And they are eager to turn NATO from a defensive regional alliance into a global intervention force. Many maximalists favor global membership for the alliance, and they believe that special partnership, if not full membership, should be extended to like-minded democracies such as Australia, New Zealand, Korea, etc. Now, NATO's main continental members, that is France and Germany, are somewhere in between. France, as you know, withdrew from the integrated military structure in 1966, but is expected to rejoin the military structure in April at the alliance 60th anniversary. But I think this doesn't mean that France has really embraced NATO. I think France remains deeply committed to its own independent nuclear posture, and I think many in France remain ambivalent toward NATO. And here, France's participation, I think, in Afghanistan is illustrative. I think France sends enough troops to Afghanistan to be considered an important player and have a seat at the table. But I would argue that Afghanistan is not a top priority in Paris. France is very much focused on Europe and on building up Europe's defense capability. And as far as NATO membership is concerned, France is definitely a minimalist and has no enthusiasm whatsoever for NATO expansion. Germany's position regarding missions and memberships and capability is also ambivalent. Germany is highly dependent upon on Russia for energy supplies, and it doesn't really want to take any actions that would upset Moscow. And I think Germany's actions at the Bucharest summit in April 2008 were telling. It was because of Germany that the Ukraine and Georgian bids for NATO membership were stopped. In terms of capabilities and in terms of mission, Germany is also on the fence. It is a large troop contributor to the operation in Afghanistan, but it has also severely limited the type of actions these troops can engage in. In terms of NATO military capabilities, I'll be very brief there. I think actually here all European members, whether they are the new or old NATO members, are minimalist, and this has been a source of friction between Europeans and Americans for many years. So there are very deep divisions within the alliance as to the future roles and mission of the alliance, and whether the alliance should be involved in challenges ranging from terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, to energy security, cyber security, or more assertive Russian actions. And I think the alliance right now does not have enough internal cohesion to really start a meaningful discussion on this or start developing a new strategic concept. In addition, I think it is far from clear where NATO should really take the lead on a lot of these security challenges of the 21st century. A lot of these challenges require civilian responses and not military options, including, I would argue, the challenges of a more assertive Russia. It requires soft power, smart diplomacy, and not kinetic force. So NATO, I think, remains a valuable military organization, but its role in Caucasus is limited. And I would argue that NATO should not extend a membership action plan to Georgia or Ukraine, either in December or in April next year. And in the question and answer period, we can go back to the issue of why I think that is so. Let me go to briefly to the role of the EU. I think the immediate response of the EU to the conflict in Georgia was quite effective. Nicolas Sarkozy, the European Union president, was in Moscow shortly after the breakout of the conflict. He managed to broker a ceasefire, bring about a withdrawal of Russian troops. And I think the EU has been accepted by both parties as an honest broker and a neutral mediator. The EU will be fielding some 300 monitors in Georgia. And I think the EU has provided the Russians with a face-saving way out of this conflict, a little bit, you know, how UN peacekeeping operations used to function. Now, this is not to say that there are no problems. Of course, there are disagreements about how many soldiers should remain in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, where EU monitors can go, but I think the immediate overall results are quite positive. That said, the EU, like NATO, has a more fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem of the EU is that it has no common Russia policy. And the reason that it has no Russia policy is that first, European countries, many of which are also NATO members, have very different opinions about Moscow's goals and intentions. And second, they have very different interests, in particular economic and energy interests. Russia is dependent on Europe as a consumer of its gas and oil. But unfortunately, the EU cannot leverage its status as long as bilateral energy relations persist. Europe's energy relationship with Russia is built on bilateral economic energy relations. And that severely restricts Europe's leverage towards Russia. So I think unless the EU is able to come up with a common energy policy, relations with Russia will remain unbalanced. And I think in the end, Russia will be holding most of the cards for the immediate future. And I think this is also at the heart, and I'll conclude with this, is at the heart of the transatlantic differences. I think geographic proximity and economics are at the root of the differences between the US and Europe when it comes to Russia. Both the US and Europe are committed, at least at a rhetorical level, to consolidating democracy, to promoting liberal market economies across the European countries. But most policymakers and experts in the US view the countries in the Caucasus and its relation with Russia in strategic terms. I think their views are based on geopolitics and security and are to be seen in a broader context of global interests and perspectives. If you look at the economic links, the energy ties, and even the links between American and Russian societies, they're actually relatively thin when you compare those ties with Russian-European ties. And just to give you one figure, the volume of US-Russian trade was about $26-27 billion compared to $350 billion for the European Union. So I think that is a figure that illustrates the difference in relationship between Russia and the EU and Russia and the United States. I think Russian-EU relations have a far more regional focus than Russia-US relations. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Shantai. Let me now give the floor to Vladislav Zubak, who will give us, as he put it, a transnational perspective on these important questions. Thanks.
Well, I could never imagine I would stand here speaking about Russian-Georgian war, because 18 years ago I was at this venerable institution commenting on the origins of the Cold War, and we discussed the long telegram of George Kennan and the Soviet response to it. Those were the days we thought we were entering a prosperous and peaceful world. Why it is painful for me to comment on this, when in Russia they say we shouldn't extend our hostility to Saakashvili government, to Georgian people. The Georgians are fraternal people. People in the West kind of smirk. Russians are serious about it because, you know, the number of Georgian poets, military heroes, playwrights, cultural artistic figures, are immense. They're part of Russian culture as much as Russian culture is part of Georgian culture, at least until recently. For Americans, I don't know, I will ask you to raise your hand how many of you knew where Abkhazia and South Ossetia was until recently, probably a few. For tens of millions of Russians, that was a favorite place for their vacation during, you know, just 20 years ago. I would begin my talk by commenting, or polemicizing rather, with a recent speech of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on Russian-Western relations. I happen to know Secretary Rice in the older days when she was an expert in the Czechoslovak army and Soviet army. I'm observing her in her new role, what struck me, I agree with so many points in her speech, to my surprise, because I wasn't prepared for it. First, I read some hostile Russian comments on her speech and thought it must be something totally belligerent and dreadful. No, it was a very accommodating, surprisingly balanced speech. However, I would like to polemicize with several viewpoints in expressed by Secretary Rice. One point is certain self-righteousness and complacency about the policy of the U.S. and the West in general towards Russia under the Clinton and the Bush administrations. It seems from the speech that the United States did it all right. West did everything all right. Only Secretary Rice added, we didn't realize how many Russians suffered because when we did everything all right, and how many of them felt humiliated and dishonored when we did everything all right. Well, I would say that the NATO expansion and the EU expansion to a certain limit was a major success of Western policies and tremendously a positive project for Central Europe. But after a while, it began to become a victim of its own success, and various problems developed, primarily with integrating countries that were on the border of Russia, and primarily of offering some kind of vision for Russia itself and Russian people. At no point, at least to my understanding, under the Clinton and the Bush administration, Russian people saw a vision that they could share with their, you know, Central Eastern neighbors. That there's something good for them. You know, the Bolts got a lucky card. They had been harshly treated by history before. Poles, don't mention Poles, you know, the playground of history for years and years and years. But Russia was not exactly in a happy state either during the 20th century. So while Poles and the Bolts got the lucky ticket and got integrated into Europe and can enjoy now visa-free and, you know, prosper a productive relationship with the rest of the people of Europe, Russians feel now barred from that development, not only by visa barriers, but by the newly emerging Central European lobby that argues basically that Russia is incurable, and all bad things that had befallen them during the 20th century was the fault of the Russians. Mind it, not the Soviet Union. Russia and the Russians. And I was happy to find in Secretary Rice's speech that Russia is not the Soviet Union, and it's truly not in every possible sense. I can speak more about it. Also, I felt in Secretary Rice's speech kind of shallowness of historical background. I'm a historian, so I'm partial on this, but for U.S. for policymakers, everything seems to begin with the end of the Cold War. And when I read the testament of Nicholas Burns at the U.S. Congress, he begins to talk about Russian-Georgian relations as if those two states fell from the moon in 1991 and nothing existed on that place before. This is certainly wrong. Not that I believe that history heals, no, history traumatizes. You know, as the Balkans testify, many other cases testify, we must sometimes be forced to override history, as for instance in German-French relations or in Polish-German relations, which NATO and European projects successfully did in the past, but we cannot ignore and we cannot overlook that history. You know, for Georgians, the history of the Russian Empire begins in the 18th century, you know, 1783, 1918, 1922, all those dates mean a lot for Georgians. They mean nothing for Americans, you know, if you like, I can lecture you about it, but they mean nothing for American policymakers as well. The rival historical narratives that emerged after the end of the Cold War, I read with tremendous interest what Georgian historians have produced in English, because I cannot read Georgian, and in balanced kind of accounts, Georgian historians say basically we were colonized by the Russians in the early 19th century. They violated the pact that we signed with them when we wanted them to protect us against the Turks and the Persians, you know, all these familiar nations. But one good thing they did, they brought European culture to us. Second good thing they did, they helped us to gather Georgian lands for us. Well, of course, Russians never intended to gather Georgian lands for the Georgians. It was a transnational empire. What historians of Georgia rarely mention is that Joseph Stalin had Georgian half a city and helped them to create the present-day boundaries of the state of Georgia. What we now think as whole, or the whole is the territorial integrity of Georgia, these boundaries have been drawn under direct supervision of Joseph Stalin. So we can go on and on about history, but there, this one fact I should bring your attention to, there are rival narratives. And they're very different. From the Russian perspective, they saved Georgia from, subjugation to the Muslim nations at the time. Christian nation helped the Christian nation. From the perspective of other people that I will talk more about, people, tribes of Northern Caucasus, it was the big empire, Russia, that came to rescue the little empire, Georgia, against, all kinds of threats, by the way, trampling on the freedom of independence of all the people of Northern Caucasus in the process. So all these rival narratives are passed from generation to generation. They're now taught at high schools to millions and millions of kids, and those Georgian and Russian and Chechen conscripts that fought in the recent war, they had a different image of what was right and what was wrong, what was the right kind of history and what was true. That is very important to imagine, and this is something that Americans just don't have any clue about. Also, Secretary of State Rice mentioned, thanks goodness that we are no longer hostage, U.S. policy is no longer hostage to one issue that used to be the Soviet Union. She even said that, we looked at everything through Soviet lenses, now we're free from that. Well, I would argue not quite. There's still some lenses, when you talk about Russia, common sense recedes and you feel all the ghosts and goblins of the Cold War and the past and the Cossacks and backward Asiatic power coming up in the minds and imaginations of many people in America, especially those from the area. I would say that U.S. policy is not free today from some Cold War images and from Russian lenses and from anti-Russian lobbies that are very active in this country for very understandable reasons. I would mention Polish, Ukrainian, the Bolts, and now, of course, the Georgian lobby that Hope Harrison mentioned. When it comes to a Russian lobby, I would search and search for it in Washington, I wouldn't find it. It simply doesn't exist. So we have an imbalance of anti-Russian lobbies versus the virtual absence of pro-Russian lobby in this country. And this is, as every insider here inside the Beltway would say, this is an important matter when policies are made in Washington, D.C. Now, something is not mentioned also in Rice's speech, which is Caucasus. Caucasus is even more complicated piece of land than the Balkans. And the United States, it took a while for the United States to discover the complexity of the Balkans. Now the United States, as I heard, that phrase that the future of NATO will depend on what will happen in the Caucasus. I tremble. Because it would be such a sad thing if NATO would really stake its future on the Caucasus without really realizing where it's going to. It's an immensely complex situation. In fact, all the insiders, all the people who live in Southern Caucasus and Northern Caucasus keep talking now not about Russian-Georgian relations, but about the danger of an explosion of Northern Caucasus. In instability in Ingushetia, again another piece of land, nobody has a clue where it is, but it's Northern Caucasus. Instability and possible insurrection in Dagestan, this is what people now in the region discuss. And there's a long history. Russia came to the Caucasus in the 19th century, fought over 50 years to conquer those lands. Russia had to resettle sometimes quite brutally in the 1860s. a little bit less than 1 million people from Western Caucasus to Turkey after negotiating with the Ottoman Empire. I know some historians look at it as a first case of a planned ethnic cleansing or ethnic equilibration in European history. You have now Stalin's landmines all over the Caucasus, because Stalin was the Commissar for Nationalities and then, you know, the leader of the Soviet Union. Who drew the borders in the way that some Ossetia is now living in southern Ossetia under the sovereignty of Georgia and some Ossetia is living in the north? Who did it? Stalin did. The Soviet state, at least, did that. And if we ignore these landmines, we will not never understand the complexity that not only Americans, not only NATO will confront, but Russians are confronting. Russians are confronted. Russians got into that lock, stock, and barrel. You know, some people say, why are you going into Chechnya? You're going to refight all these wars, and haven't you forgot the 19th century? Well, they did it. They burned the bridges. They crossed the Rubicon. It's too late to argue. It's already reality. And Russians now have to rule the Northern Caucasus with all its implications. So if you follow the events, I'm probably not, a string of mysterious contracts. Murders, including the last murder in Moscow of the person, the Chechen, who actually led the Russian Chechen troops into Georgia during the recent war. It was not even daylight in Moscow. You wonder, what is going on there? And some specialists explain, well, how the Russians won the war in Chechnya. They just picked the worst criminal there, appointed him a viceroy there. And they rule by leaning on some clans, trying to, fight other clans, and sometimes killing, unacceptable people from other clans. But this is not a policy. This is not a strategy for the region. Infusion of money into the region by the Russians end up, in more corruption and disaster. So inheriting the Caucasus is not a simple thing. Letting the Caucasus go, guys, do you want a second Afghanistan? It's also not an option. I frankly don't know what the option is, but this is, for me, one huge issue that European Union, if it wants, NATO, if it wants, and certainly Georgians and Russians have to think about together, not against each other. Is this war is an exceptional case, or a new threat is looming for stability of Europe, or maybe entire Eurasia, sort of a Russian power? When you go to Baltic websites, some Ukrainian websites, Polish websites, they're scared. They fear Russia. And you feel again all the images of the past with Cossacks with their lances and whips, with the Tsarist Empire, with the commissars. Many of those commissars were Poles and Ukrainians and all of them, and Georgians, by the way, not to mention when they say what are three Georgians in a joke? It's the Politburo. It was an old Soviet joke. But if you read, listen to these sources, we have a falling domino here. We're back to the Cold War rhetoric. People use it right and left. It's, free world versus Russia. It's captive nations. It's all this stuff I thought we would be left behind. But it lives on in people's memory, and thus remains the factor of policy. In Russia, things are also quite bad. Frankly, what we saw during the war and immediately after the war is the familiar effect of Raj Militaire. Although Russia responded to Georgian attack, then everybody in Russia saw international news and were appalled to see that Russia was blamed for the war, and they could never understand it. They're all hypocrites. They're all against Russia. That's why. So 75% of Russians, according to the polls, supported Russia and thought there was a just war. 85% of people who read internet news, as I learned from our colleagues, so more educated, more sophisticated people supported the war, partly because, I think it was frankly psychological backlash against the West. Why the West is so uneven in covering this conflict and so on and so forth. I hope now, and I see it now, this Raj Militaire is subsiding. People, Russians, for all other bad things that I can say, but Russians, you know, they let bygones be bygones. I mean, if you're interested, look how they treat Germans now. You know, they love Germans. You know, after that war, that you think, you know, 27 million Russians were killed. They love Russians. I mean, they love Germans now. So when you say, you know, it's not impossible, it's not possible to restore Russian Germany, it's possible. And it can be done very, very quickly. We need new policies. Well, I think I'm all for EU mediation, because right now, frankly, at least for the next few months, American mediation is completely impossible. There's no trust in U.S. Fair game in Russia. However, when the new administration comes to the White House, there must be some kind of new beginning. It would be the worst policy for the U.S. administration to immediately invite Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. I'm not saying it because I believe these countries should not be in NATO. It's all a matter of timing. Invite Ukraine into NATO, and until 2017, you'll have the problem of the Russian Black Navy fleet sitting in the Crimea. How are you going to deal with that? That's a powder keg for you. If you invite Georgia, you know, people of the Caucasus will see it as basically the Caucasus is divided between U.S. and Russia into two spheres of influence. Until you sort it out, which might take a while, you cannot really do it. And above all, it will send a very bad psychological message. It should be a new beginning. It should be some kind of meeting between Medvedev and whoever is American president in a few months. And the message that one sometimes hears here, it's very vital to make it that Russia should lose after this war, should not profit from it, should be not punished. This word is no longer used, but implications is that, you know, if Russians would perceive they gain something after this conflict, that means the falling domino effect would start. Oh my goodness. I think it's profoundly wrong reading of history. I would treat the last war as an exceptional case, as a very, very unfortunate, disastrous even development, but more, you know, dealing more like conditioned by the past. And I think that the Americans should take a better grasp of geography and history of the area. And you know, I know it's kind of hopeless, but American electronic media is kind of wonderful. It focuses on one piece of land in the world and doesn't see anything around it, even the vicinity. Yeah, I don't know how to change that, but you know, if we had CNN or Fox News representatives here, we could talk about that. But that's my mild suggestion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Vladislav. Let's turn now to Luke Vozdov, who will react to some or what the panelists have said, and perhaps pose some questions to kick off the discussion.
Thank you, Abby. Let me start with the disclaimer that my comments are my own. They do not necessarily reflect those the positions of the War College, the Navy, or the U.S. government. Let me start first taking off something that Hope said at the end about whether or not what has happened could backfire on Russia. And I think less on the relationship between Russia and the West specifically, but what could then have an impact in the overall global balance, which is the reaction of the rising South and East to what has happened, particularly the Russian recognition of the independence of Ossetia and Abkhazia, which was not something that was well received in China, in India, in Indonesia, South Africa, Brazil. They were supportive of Russian actions up to a point. I think many of the rising southern and eastern powers could identify with the notion of Russia intervening on the basis of preserving regional stability. But when Russia went further and said, not only are we trying to intervene to restore stability as we see it, but we are now going to recognize the independence of these two separatist regimes. That was a bridge too far for many of these powers, and even for other states within the former Soviet Union and the Shanghai grouping. So over time, what will be interesting to see is whether or not less what the West's reaction is, but whether or not this has an impact in Russia's ability, as it was beginning to do somewhat successful, of consolidating its relationship with China, with India, with others. The Yekaterinburg summit earlier this year that brought Brazil in as well, Russia's moves with the IMF last year, the sense of Russia putting together and being a leader of a coalition of rising southern and eastern states. Now, the sense is that, well, perhaps Russia is not, Russia is just like, in some ways, is just like the United States. The United States dismembers states in the case of Kosovo from Serbia, and now Russia's doing the same thing. The other interesting thing, of course, will be, and this is maybe a bit outside of the immediate topic of Russia and the West, but I think something to keep in mind, what this does for the immediate future efforts of the international community. And I think what we're beginning to see is that there really isn't an international community as much as there are groupings of states. What this does, the Russian claims to be doing in Georgia what the West had done in Yugoslavia, the responsibility to protect, the coming in to intervene, whether or not the reaction in the rising South and East will be to really therefore emphasize the importance of state sovereignty and the inviolability of territorial integrity, both against the attempts of the West, but perhaps now also of Russia, to erode those norms. And that could lead to a new East-West crisis, not the of Russia versus the West, but of the global, or the developed North and North and West pairing up against the global rising South and East. And I think that's something to keep in mind. Turning, I think, to the questions raised by NATO, one of the things that has struck me about the reaction of different countries in the alliance to what has happened, and of course Georgia is not a former member, it has no treaty, there are no obligations of NATO to Georgia in any kind of treaty form, but the reactions afterwards, I think, point to a trend in NATO which moves away from seeing Article 5 guarantees as absolute, and much more the idea that individual NATO members have the right to assess whether they think a country provoked a neighbor. We saw this initially beginning in 2003 when France, Belgium, and Germany initially resisted applying Article 4 and Article 5 to Turkey, that if Turkey was to get involved in a U.S.-led war against Iraq, that Turkey could not automatically count on NATO help if Iraq were to retaliate against Turkey. And I think some of the thinking that we have seen in some of the writings, the editorial writings in the European press, saying, well, even if Georgia had been in the alliance, and maybe it's a good thing that it's not, but even if it had been, would this have necessarily required an Article 5 response, or do individual members of the alliance have the ability to assess whether or not they think they will uphold their Article 5 guarantees? And I think this is a big change from Soviet days, when it was assumed that a Soviet move across the Oder-Neisse line through the Fulda Gap into the Baltic Sea would automatically trigger a unified NATO response. And this is part of this issue of the alliance having to determine what it is going to be, what its missions are. And one can really see the alliance moving in the direction less of being a unified security organization and much more being the toolbox. That is, it allows for countries to work together, and then if they choose to cooperate on a particular mission, they have interoperability, but that Article 5 is no longer necessarily an automatic tripwire as it was during the Cold War period. The other thing I think that this has demonstrated very clearly is that the U.S. is no longer in a position to drive the process of expansion on its own. If you look at lobbying efforts traditionally in each of the rounds of NATO expansion at the end of the Cold War, essentially the thinking was if you got the U.S. on board, to support your bid for expansion, that the U.S. would bring the rest of the alliance along. And even with Georgia and Ukraine, there was a sense all the way up through to the end of 2007 that there might be European objections, but that the U.S. somehow would prevail, would convince Germany, would convince France, would convince other states that, to go along with it. And I think that we that illusion should be shattered by now, that the U.S. unilaterally is no longer in a position to simply, if the U.S. is convinced that NATO should expand, then that automatically will occur. The question of the minimalist approach, and one of the things that this may then apply to what happens now as the dust is settling in the South Caucasus. This is not the situation on the ground as it now exists in the South Caucasus. It exists in Georgia, vis-a-vis Russia, and then South Ossetia and Abkhazia. This isn't new for Europe. Having a smaller country that is subject to a military intervention by a large neighbor who comes in to defend a population that it claims has been oppressed, and then under the protection of that power, that region declares that it is an independent state. We know this is called Cyprus. Whether or not what's going to happen in the South Caucasus is that Georgia becomes the Cyprus of the 21st century, right? We all know that everyone is committed to the de jure territorial integrity of Cyprus. There are UN resolutions all the way back to 1974, and I don't want to call attention to anyone's age, but just looking out into the audience, I think there are people who might not even have been born in this audience in 1974 that called for all foreign troops to depart the island. The Turkish Republic of North Cyprus self-declared, celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, recognized by only one country in the world as an independent state, Turkey. No other country recognizes it. Everyone recognizes that there is a single island, but more or less, the world has gotten used to drawing a distinction between what it says de jure and what it accepts de facto, and that is that the island of Cyprus is divided, and that particularly if one goes to northern Cyprus, it's a very popular place for Europeans, particularly British, to own real estate and to travel there. It's an unrecognized entity that has tens of thousands of Europeans who are there, even though their governments officially don't recognize the existence of that state, the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus. And so the question is whether or not the minimalist approach in the South Caucasus is that everyone more or less says, yeah, Georgia should be a single territorially unified state. No one recognizes de jure a Republic of Abkhazia or a Republic of South Ossetia, but beyond that, it just becomes an equilibrium, a status quo. Talks, you can have the UN Secretary General, subsequent UN Secretary Generals continue to offer their good offices, you can continue to have negotiations in the Geneva process, can continue, and people that want to deal with it. A perhaps silver lining for Georgia is that once Turkey intervened in Cyprus, essentially that removed any Turkish veto on the Republic of Cyprus, Greek Cyprus, from pursuing its own foreign policy, and of course the European Union said that Turkey could not exercise a veto over Cyprus's ability to join the European Union. So one of the, if there's a silver lining for Georgia in this status quo, is that it may be that over time the European Union and perhaps NATO will say, fine, Georgia's not, there are areas of Georgia outside of its control, namely Abkhazia and South Ossetia, but Russia has no, we're not going to allow Russia to use the division of Georgia as a bar for sort of the core of Georgia to move into the transatlantic institutions. And maybe Chantal, specifically to you, but to anyone on the panel, whether or not you think some of the more recent statements by Angela Merkel before Bucharest, she sort of said, well, Georgia is not territorially united, and that's a bar for its NATO membership. Now she's saying, well, maybe it's not going to happen right away, but we think if Georgia wants to be in NATO, it can happen, and whether or not that is an application of this sort of Cyprus of the 21st century principle. Just some thoughts also in listening to Vladislav's presentation, but also they came up when Hope and Chantal were speaking as well. And this is a question of leverage. And going back and looking at the leverage that the EU and the United States did have over its relationship with Russia, and the extent to which, over the last number of years, it was squandered. The EU held up its partnership agreement with Russia over meat exports, the ability of Poland to export meat to Russia. The U.S. Congress has delayed graduating Russia from Jackson's Act because of chicken exports. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there is a thinking in Russia, in Russian foreign policy circles, that says if the West is going to hold up a key agreement with us because of chicken, then who cares if we're going to Georgia? Because, it's all the same. No matter what we do, there will always be something that the EU or the U.S. will find fault with. So we might as well just do this operation in Georgia. It's not like it's going to, change opinion, and it's certainly not in the U.S. Congress. But perhaps the inability of Europe as the EU and then the United States to prioritize the leverage it did have with Russia, so that essentially anything that Russia did that the West didn't like was used as we can hold up an agreement, to the point then that the agreements themselves start to become meaningless. And we're also seeing this with WTO, that where Russian circles up to, I would say, about a year ago were very much interested in moving ahead with the WTO, and now the sense is, well, if we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't, we'll just follow what we think is in our interests, and if that means we don't get into the WTO right away, we can learn to live with that. And so I think that this should focus thinking in both Brussels, other European capitals of European nation states, and then in Washington and Ottawa, about how you plan to use your leverage. And you have to decide what are the issues you're going to go to bat on. And because chicken, I'm sorry to pick on the U.S. chicken expert, but because you made chicken a priority for so many years, it's a lot harder for you then to turn around and say, well, Georgia's really serious, and now you're going to really apply the leverage. When basically anything that was a mark against Russia was being used by different lobbies in Congress, chicken exporters and so on, to hold up agreements, then that's one of the reasons that the West doesn't have necessarily the leverage it might have had over Russia to alter or modify its behavior. Listening to Vladislav's presentation, I think, again, and just discussing about when do you take your snapshot of what you define as the territorial integrity of a state. In this case, does Stalin's ability to draw a border make it sacrosanct? I mean, that's a question that we've really danced around. We sort of said, well, states' territorial integrity is important, but then when Tito's Yugoslavia started to come apart, well, maybe we can modify it in certain areas, and we just have not had a serious discussion, not only within the West, but the West and then to the South and East, about how we balance questions about self-determination and territorial integrity of states. And not only the U.S., but now Russia is incredibly inconsistent in how they apply these principles, whether territorial integrity takes precedence over the right of national groups to self-determination, and as a result you have a very unpredictable situation that emerges, and that where a number of countries are drawing the conclusion that in the end it's power politics that matters, not principle that drives us, it's power politics. There was a time when, we look at other frozen conflicts around the world in the greater Black Sea region, and then looking the Middle East. Indonesia, of course, is concerned because of the autonomy agreements it's negotiated and so on and so forth. But this is really Kosovo in 2008, and then Abkhazia and Osetia in 2008 have not really provided an answer to this question, and it's just going to keep, instead of having somehow solved this issue, I think it's going to keep coming up again and again, and that will be, I'm sure Abby will be convening other seminars. You have, Western Sahara, you have Somaliland versus Somalia, Kurdistan, we're delaying, I think the agreement in Iraq is they'll delay the referendum for Kirkuk at least for a while longer, so we've dodge the bullet for a few more months on that, but sooner or later all of these things are going to come back and they're boiling up, and that's something to keep in mind. And then finally, just the last thought
on Russia and the West and Georgia and all of these issues is that you really see, and I accept that this is a simplification, but just simply for having two categories, but two different visions of how order is to be structured. There is the clear Russian, what appears to be a clear Russian predilection for the Congress of Vienna system, which is that states sit down when they have issues, they come up with agreements, whether or not people affected by those agreements may or may not want those settlements is less important than great powers sitting down and smaller powers getting a chance to weigh in at the table, and then you work out a settlement and an arrangement that provides for a certain balance among the interests of the different powers, running up against, you know, the vision, particularly in Europe, of the Maastricht Treaty, you know, states all coming together into a common project where there are no dominant states or weaker states, and spheres of influence are, you know, concept of the past. And then you have the U.S., which is somehow inconsistently in the middle. I very much enjoyed the editorial in the New York Sun a few days ago that said that the sending of Russian warships to take part in exercises in Venezuela was a violation of American sovereignty, which I didn't quite understand how, as long as the Russian ships stayed in international waters and Venezuela actually invited them, how that was a violation of U.S. sovereignty. But, you know, the point being, and the next paragraph was maybe we should remind Russians about what President Monroe said about the Western Hemisphere. And that in and of itself is potentially inconsistent, which is that if the U.S. sort of says the Western Hemisphere is a sphere of influence, but Europe and Eurasia, there are no spheres of influence and no dominant powers. Well, you can see why you might run into some difficulties there. And then just finally, I think this question of what the next administration does, going to be very critical. I think that unlike what happened in 2000, when oil was $20 a barrel, when the U.S. economy was robust, when U.S. ties with key allies were much stronger than they are now, whoever comes into the White House in 2009 comes with a much weaker set of cards. Not that the U.S. has lost all influence, that's certainly not the case, but a weakened hand, cannot necessarily count on, even within Europe, that key European allies, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, among them, are necessarily going to follow the American lead on this, where significant other major powers, not only China but India, have essentially said that they have no stake in the Russian dispute with the West over Georgia, that this is not something that they're going to get involved in. You know, the extent to which the U.S. Is going to be prepared to raise some of these issues and then not simply oppose Russia, but risk some of its relations with some of its other partners. I'm less concerned about a new Cold War between Russia and the West than I am about a major rupture occurring between a U.S. president in 2009 with President Sarkozy and Chancellor Merkel, two leaders who only a few years ago were being described as pro-American and would be helping to restore the transatlantic relationship. And I think that that is going to be a subject of concern. It's not necessarily Russia and the West, but it's going to be whether there is a West in this case, and to what extent the U.S. will try to move with its European partners on this issue, to what extent it's not prepared perhaps to accept some of the compromises that the Europeans, at least the continental Europeans, West Europeans, have been prepared to make. And so this may become less of an issue of do we have a bad relationship with Russia, and more does this begin to repeat the 2003 splits over Iraq that did a lot to damage the transatlantic relationship. So I think that's something that we should also be very, very aware of. So let me stop there.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Nick. I think to thank all of the four panelists for those excellent presentations, we've had a lot of food for thought. Looking at the clock, since we on this side of the room have been going on for about an hour and a half, I think
since we've all been on your side, you're probably eager to get into this discussion. So Nick has raised a number of points. What I would suggest is that we open it up to questions to give you an opportunity, participants, to raise your questions, and then perhaps panelists could react as appropriate to some of the points that Nick has already put on the table. Okay, so let me again open it up and ask you to identify yourself and your affiliation.
Yes, Robert Friedman, Johns Hopkins University. Again, I would like to thank the panelists for a very stimulating discussion. I have 2 points, very briefly. One, to Vladislav, Georgia was not a unique action by Russia. Over the last few years, Mr. Putin's doing a number of negative things, whether it's inviting Hamas to Moscow and breaking the quartet unity on this, or arming Iran, and I could go through a whole list. And some people might argue the Georgian thing was just the latest in a series of very negative things which Russia has done under Mr. Putin's leadership. But perhaps more important than this, and this gets, I guess, to hope, when we're looking at the American-Russian relationship now, seems to be a division between those who want to penalize Russia, show no business as usual on the one hand, and on the other hand, there seems to be those who argue, look, we have a lot of common interests with Russia. Now, one could argue, perhaps, that the minimum common interest is preventing loose nukes from getting out, and both of us common interest in reducing strategic arms, and maybe cooperating on Afghanistan. The Russians have not been helpful on Iran. As some people say, we need them in Iran. I'd be interested in your reaction. My study is they've not been helpful in Iran. They've not been helpful in North Korea. There's some people say we need them. So I wonder if you would be kind enough to just list where you think are the common interests of the U.S. and Russia, which have to be preserved, and those things which are not, quote, business as usual, where we can show our displeasure without shooting ourselves in the foot.
Well, I think the list of common interests is pretty obvious. Has been discussed many times by the U.S. officials. It's nuclear non-proliferation. It's fighting terrorism. It's also, I believe, we discussed the chicken war and WTO, integration of Russia into global and financial system is in everybody's interest. No question about it. Russians are losing a lot of money these days, like all of us, because of turmoil in the world. They're definitely part of it, and a huge contrast to where the Soviets were, at least towards the end. The list of little crimes and big misdemeanors that the Putin administration did during the last years, everybody knows that, but these are things of different order. These are things of different order. Inviting Hamas to Moscow may be seen as a slap in the face of the United States, but it can be seen from the Russians' perspective as an attempt to increase its leverage in the Middle East. And plus, everybody knows how the U.S. treated Yasser Arafat for years, and then Arafat became a respectable figure, or almost respectable figure, in some quarters. So it's all in the eyes of the beholder. What is the Russian message here? And I've been following it, and I'm not agreeing with, believe me, with many things that they say on the official level. Is that we live in a multipolar world. When Secretary Rice says it's not about unipolar or bipolar or multipolar. Well, it's not yet clear. It's not clear what kind of world we're living then in. From Russia's perspective, it's clear that they must have the privileges of a great power because of their size, because of their history, they must have some kind of privileged interests. And immediately the reaction in the Russian neighborhood is panic. Oh my goodness, they're climbing the Soviet Union back. But just to remind you as a historian, that even FDR hoped when he was alive that he would be, it would be possible to negotiate with Joseph Stalin open sphere of influence for the Soviet Union. It was utopian, of course, on FDR's part, and knowing Joseph Stalin, as we know now, it wasn't possible. But why it's not possible with Putin's Russia to leave aside this talk about privileged interests or what? It's a reality. It's the reality that countries that surround Russia are intertwined with Russia. There's 1 million Georgians living in Russia, and they send money to their relatives in Georgia. Tens of millions in Ukraine and Russia that are relatives, and will remain so. It's impossible not to have special interests for Russia in Georgia and in Ukraine. It's just a matter of how you understand it.
Yeah, this debate of sort of punishing Russia versus integrating it reminds me of all I read about the Cold War, which somehow I never thought I'd live through. But finding myself, you know, having to take a stand on this, it gives me some understanding for what people did go through during the Cold War. I mean, one thing we found out, for better or worse, is, you know, as I said, and we've all mentioned, I mean, even if we wanted to punish Russia, we just don't have the leverage. And I forget if it was Nick or Vlad who said the interest that Russia has, it was Nick saying, you know, we'd always find some reason, whether it's chicken or something else, not to end up with an agreement that Russia was looking for. And so Russia finally, you know, not surprisingly, has said, we're going to go after our own interests because somehow the West isn't taking our interests into account. I agree with what Vlad said about the common interests that we have. I guess there's got to be some middle ground in the sense of a strategically important country that we have to get along with, even though we don't always agree with them, and they don't always agree with us. This in U.S.-Russian relations has been very difficult. As many commentators have written over certainly the past two decades, somehow America and Americans and American presidents tend to personalize and really emotionalize relations with Russia. We have all these hopes that, Russia can quickly and easily become a democracy like us, and when it doesn't happen as quickly as we want to, and Americans aren't known for patience, then we feel really let down and betrayed and get into sort of a backlash, and that's certainly something that's happening again, I think. Somehow it seems to be difficult for the U.S. to treat Russia in some sort of more objective, non-emotional way and understand that, as with other countries, I mean, Germany, you know, there was a freeze on U.S.-German relations over Iraq. It was terrible. We didn't assume that meant all sorts of things about the German character and they were going back to the old days. You know, there was an understanding that there was just a profound disagreement about Iraq, and that Schroeder was also playing electoral politics in Germany and knew he'd get a lot of votes by being against the war in Iraq. So somehow that's something that everybody in the U.S., from policymakers to scholars to journalists, need to work on more of an objective approach to Russia, I think.
Thank you.
Yes. My name is Astrid Munn. I'm a reporter with the Scripps Howard Foundation Wire. I think I was reading in the news that the current START treaty will be expiring soon, and I was wondering how current tensions between the U.S. and Russia, how that could affect the treaty's future.
I think this really depends on the elections and what happens. And who's going to be the new president?
Okay.
right. Well, I tell you what, what I'm going to do is, why don't you, all those who want to ask questions, come up to the microphones on either side. I'll take in sets of three, so we can have those. So, yeah.
My name is Karine Rushanyan, and I work for International Broadcasting Bureau. And this is a very nice forum. And I'm looking at this both from the research point as well as the media, and I totally agree how unbalanced, very unfortunate, unbalanced was the media coverage on this event, because what the first step and what the reaction, I think that's where we want to go. And we fortunately see some comeback, and totally agree with Vladislav saying that we can't just go to the modern day of the action. We have to have the background, and we have to consider all as much as possible circumstances, historic facts. And my question will be to Hope and Vladislav, to Hope first, to what do you understand, I mean, how do you understand when you say Georgia is a special partner, or you said ally, or something about in that area. Why Georgia is special other than others in the Caucasus?
She said.
Okay.
And what's the second question?
And to Vladislav, when you're talking about boundaries and the frozen conflicts, how do you view those in the whole Caucasus a little bit more
detail? Okay.
I'm Caitlin Antrim. I work on ocean affairs, and so I'm interested in how the opening of the Northern Ocean is going to affect Russia and the West. In particular, the approval this last week of a development plan for the southern Arctic region, the opening of oil and gas reserves and mineral resources of the North. Putin's commitment this week to rebuilding the icebreaker fleet and opening the Northern Sea Route, which will give Russia its blue water port to both the Atlantic and Pacific, something long sought. And as the temperatures go up and the rivers are open more of the year, give it transportation routes to the inland. So what I see in the future, a movement to the east of Russian interests, and that east movement will mean moving to the north, which also will open trade possibilities with the United States and Canada. So I see a change in focus that may be coming in the generation ahead. And you may not have looked too hard at that, but I'd like some idea as to what do you think that might look like from the Russian perspective.
Thank you. My name is Alex Pimenov, and I am working for the Russian service of the Voice of America. And I also wanted to thank you for the wonderful discussion, but on the other hand, listening to some speakers, I was thinking of how dangerous is the historical knowledge, because being able to understand everything and everyone is also possible. I mean, it's a highly effective tool to justify everything and everyone. And here's my concern, because from the very beginning of the Georgian conflict, even earlier, I've been thinking of how to explain the fact that it was so unexpected to almost anyone, except probably Professor Harrison and maybe a few others. And in this context, my concern is, and my question for all of you is, whether you feel some lack of theory. My impression is that the very nature of the current Russian society has been strongly misunderstood for a long time, because it normally has been considered a democracy, a backward, underdeveloped, imperfect, but still a democracy. It's still a capitalist society. Maybe it's a different capitalism or a different development. And that's actually my question for all of you, whether or not you feel the lack of theory and a necessity to rethink many fundamental issues regarding the very nature of the current Russian regime. Thank you.
Okay, let me just take a break here, and since we have a lot on the table, perhaps begin with
Vladislav on the dangers, misuse of history, and perhaps touching on the issue of the borders. I hope on why Georgia has a special relationship with the United States. I thought perhaps we could bring in Nick again on the oceans, yes, and moving to the east. And then perhaps, Chantal, you could take the question about theory. So why don't we move then?
Left to right.
Okay.
Yes. The opening of the ocean route to the north, and particularly the ability of Russia to obtain new sources of oil and gas, I think is something that will be quite interesting, because it challenges some of the medium-term strategic assumptions that at least some in the United States were counting on. Because first of all, if more oil and gas is opened up from the Arctic, this solves the problem of supply for Europe. That is, if Russia is able to do this, and if Russia's ability to draw, and as we've seen with Stockman, the ability to draw, it's expensive, but demand is going up, and as demand goes up, people will pay a higher price. And if you have, as we've seen, one of the key elements of, certainly of Sarkozy's diplomacy to Russia has been Total and its ability to work within the Russian framework in Stockman. So you may have, again, an interesting case where some key European interests will intermingle with Russian interests and create a community of interests, which then makes it harder for the U.S. to be able to say, well, you know, you need to join with us on, you need to join with us on opposing Russia. The other thing that this does is that if it does open up new transportation routes, I mean, what you've had, at least for the last 10 years, is the assumption that Russia's ability to get oil and gas to the market primarily through Ukraine and the states of Central Eastern Europe provided leverage for those states vis-a-vis Russia. Russia's already beginning to route around with South Stream, North Stream projects, but if you also then have the ability for super tankers to go directly from the Arctic to Western Europe, and you know the situation where 15 or 20 years from now, Russia doesn't even feel the need to have to sell natural gas to Poland, say, and says, you want the natural gas, buy it from Germany, because we'll just ship it directly there. And how that will upset the kind of assumptions that are made about the ability of sort of Central Eastern European states to play a certain balancing role vis-a-vis Russia if you have these new transport routes. And then, of course, the issue of Russia being able to then supply Far Eastern markets is also key. But I actually see the Arctic, if it does become cost-effective, is this cements Russia's position as the supplier of choice of energy to Europe. And if Nabucco and some of these other alternate pipeline and energy projects are already pretty much on their last legs, then having the Arctic open up even more kills altogether some of these other projects. It means that we do have to expect this symmetry of European and Russian interests in a way that the U.S. maybe doesn't like and isn't prepared for.
Thank you on that.
Vladislav?
Well, maybe we should have a special commission, not on nuclear non-proliferation, but on proliferation of historical narratives in the world, because history can kill as effectively as arms. And, well, maybe we should have a truth and reconciliation commission for the post-Soviet space. I don't know. U.S. Institute of Peace should think about it, and I definitely am prepared to support this effort. It's hopeless until you know to deal with this problem right now, because you know all the states, all the new republics that used to be part of the Soviet Union found themselves in dire need to create their national narratives, and they were doing it with vengeance, including Russia. The difference is that all the non-Russian states have the privilege to blame everything on Russia for whatever had befallen them in the 20th century and even earlier. That's easier for them to do. For Russians to blame everything on the Soviet Union and on the Tsarist Empire is a little bit awkward. They're still trying to do it, but you know, with less success.
anyway, on the north, I don't see it as a trend. I just see it as a very American way for Russia to go where the money is. You know, that's what Americans did in the 19th century, open frontier policy. Go young men, go north, go east, go whatever. Now it's the Russian government, of course. But I cannot stress more that if Russians will try to do it, Russians will need huge amount of foreign investments, because, you know, this oil will probably, although they probably don't know it right now, they will need more Western support and more international involvement of international capital into this than they realize. They did talk about moving, building pipelines to China, but look at the map. You know, how long these pipelines should be, how expensive it will be to build them from Eastern Siberia and Central Siberia to China. And we're talking about, you know, huge amount of money, even though Russia now boasts of a stabilization fund and significant surpluses. Russia is still not up to doing this project alone. Ice-breaking fleet, I totally support it. Russia needs it. Russia needs to restore many things that had been destroyed after the collapse of the Soviet Union, including ice-breaking fleet. This interesting question about lack of theory, I think what happened in Georgia totally fits into realist and neorealist theory. You know, pick any textbook on international relations and you find, spiral of tension, you know, security dilemma, all these familiar, you know, ABC things just work beautifully in Georgia. Georgia and Russia have been on a spiral of mutual hostility for a number of years, beginning at least with 1989, when Georgia was still part of the Soviet Union, maybe. So I disagree with Alexei. It's a lack of theory. It's our inability to apply theory to specific cases. And this tells something about ourselves, our media, and humans tend to think, oh, somehow it will, you know, it will not happen, including myself. I knew the background, just like Hope Harrison, but I was still stunned and surprised when the actual war happens. And it, you know, it's a nature of life. On the borders, the frozen territories and things, including Nagorno-Karabakh, only time can do it, a lot of time. Maybe you need this supranational authority to deal with this problem. It was the Tsarist Empire. It certainly played a role in the 19th century. Now some people hope it could be the United States. United States are involved in too many complicated areas in the world. I think the United States alone cannot do it. But listen, you know, the recent unfreezing of Armenian-Turkish relationship, brings some hope. You would think that it was completely unthinkable just a few years ago. It's happening. It takes political will. The same is the situation between Georgia and Russia. I know it sounds almost blasphemous nowadays, especially for Georgian ears, but if they admit the loss of Abkhazia and Southern Ossetia, a restoration of relationship with Russia, and maybe even some developments in Georgia's favor will be quite possible. If not immediately in the short term future, on Russia's current regime, I'm sorry to talk so long. What is this regime? You know, I would put the question differently. Are we interested in the West in a strong Russia or a weak Russia? And some people even think, you know, we should be concerned about the weak Russia more than about the strong Russia. Just one example from a certain perspective: the Saakashvili state in Georgia is stronger than the Russian state today because, hey, they managed to deal with corruption among highway police and traffic police quite effectively. When I drove on a so-called highway between Moscow and St. Petersburg this summer in Russia, I saw God. First of all, it's not a highway, it's a joke. And second, traffic police was standing at every corner taking bribes. So is that a strong state or a weak state? I think it's a surprisingly weak state. And comparing it with some kind of strong authoritarian regimes, not to mention going into totalitarianism theory, I totally disagree with that. The problem of Russia is weakness of institutions and wrong policies of the Putin government that contributed to this weakness.
Thank you. Chantal?
Well,
the only question?
I think Sam has in part already answered this. It's not so much lack of theory, I would argue. You know, it's our lack of strategy, and it goes back to the point that Nick made about the chicken policy and our need to prioritize with our relationship with Russia. I think we need to think strategically when we deal with Russia, and keep our eye on the big issues, which are proliferation, terrorism, climate change, energy security. So I think it's our lack of strategic thinking that is a real problem here.
At the beginning of my talk, I talked very specifically about why the U.S. government has treated Georgia specially because of the previous role of Shevardnadze in ending the Cold War. But I talked about the U.S. sort of emotional approach to Russia, and that applies to Georgia as well. I mean, it started with Shevardnadze, but it succeeded him to Saakashvili and to the country in general, sort of, and this does go back, I think, to sort of Cold War mindsets, the sense of protecting a country from Russian influence, wanting to really support its independence, territorial integrity, and democracy. But that has proven to be far harder than we thought. And, one big lesson I hope policymakers have learned from all of this is you got to be careful with sort of throwing around the words and, we stand by Georgia, and, we didn't when it came down to it. And, as Andy Cutchins said this week at CSIS, the U.S. was caught napping, and its policy toward Russia and Eurasia is in tatters. I think it really has been a crisis for U.S. policy toward Russia and really our standing in the world, because we're the country that has stood behind Georgia so much, and yet we couldn't do anything. Now we've sent, we're sending $1 billion in aid. It's going to be essential. Is that going to work? Is that going to go to the right places? So the pressure is still on. I mean, what happens in Georgia this winter is going to be crucial, not least for the future of Saakashvili. Other frozen conflicts in the Caucasus, Nagorno-Karabakh, I think, there's no direct sort of effect other than everyone being very careful. I mean, Russia isn't going to play the same role here of, going in and automatically recognizing Nagorno-Karabakh as independent or as part of Armenia, because Russia's not going to want to alienate Azerbaijan. So I don't think, I don't see a similar dynamic happening there, and both sides just, I think, continue to realize that hopefully, as Vlad said, time will somehow soften that conflict.
Well, you've been very patient, so I will give you the final question, particularly since we're running out of time, and then we'll just come closing.
My name is Andrea Harris. I'm currently an independent consultant here in Washington, but was serving as the regional vice president in the South Caucasus for Eurasia Foundation for 4 out of the last 5 years, and was in Georgia much of the time when all of this was building. I think anyone that knows the region well was not surprised, unfortunately, for the fact that the conflict broke out. But I think that I've been a little dismayed at some of the comments from the panel today, to be honest. I think that the EU and the U.S. missed a huge opportunity in the late 1990s to become involved in the mediation of those conflicts, which we did not. In fact, we turned down that opportunity because our attention was elsewhere. And it may well be too late to address it in a constructive manner, but I'm very dismayed at hearing so many of the panelists say this is already a done deal, made decision, because then what is the point of engaging? What is the point of the Sarkozy agreement to have international involvement? What is the aim of it? Why should we even engage if the question has already been decided? I am of the mind that it would be extremely problematic to leave the status quo as the place where we move forward from. So, and I agree with the comments about the emotional approach to Russia. However, I would note that each of the former Soviet states also have that emotional approach for good reasons, for historical reasons. And they do not view Russia as an honest broker in any way, shape, or form. Personally, when I was in Georgia, I watched the Russian media coverage of Ossetia, Abkhazia daily, and it was absolutely non-reflective of reality. So I think there's also good historical and more recent history for people to base that distrust on. Anyhow, my question to the panel would be, what is the approach? Why engage if the problem is already lost or if the situation is already solved?
Thank you. All right. In this political season, since the last round of answers moved from left to right, I would now ask us to move from right to left.
Well balanced, as one should be with your wonderful background in peacekeeping. I said that I think they've lost South Ossetia of Abkhazia, but the whole thing is not over and not everything is resolved. There are all sorts of reasons to still be engaged. I mean, the Russians still haven't pulled out of all of Georgia proper, which they're supposed to. There's still strong desire to get peacekeepers into South Ossetia and Abkhazia, so we've got to still be trying to deal with that. I'm just saying that realistically, I just can't imagine that we're going to go back to the status quo ante. But mm-hmm. there's still a lot that's left that's unresolved that we need to stay very, very engaged on. And I just have to say for a minute, that Chantal at the beginning was talking about Sarkozy's policy being so successful and engaging, and I actually had a very different read on that. I mean, it was successful to the extent that he did something, which the U.S. didn't. You know, as Kutchin said, again, the U.S. was caught napping. I mean, it's just astonishing. But I was incredibly dismayed with, you know, the many problems with the peace agreement that he brokered that had so many holes in it, and that we're, you know, still having to deal with now. So, you know, is the glass half full or half empty? I mean, yes, he did something more than the U.S. was doing, but there's still all sorts of issues that do need to be resolved, and therefore we definitely need to still be engaged on this issue.
Thanks.
Just on Sarkozy, I think what's the aim here is to stop the violence and to stop the escalation, and I think in that the EU and Sarkozy have been very successful, and of course there are going to be problems down the road, we know that, but as long as we continue to engage the Russians, I think that's a positive thing. One other brief remark on the remark made by Nick about Article 5 of NATO. We've actually, you know, throughout NATO's history, had discussions about Article 5, and so this is not something new. The problem, however, is that the more you question Article 5, the more irrelevant NATO, of course, becomes. And if NATO becomes more of a toolbox, which could be a good thing, the question then becomes a toolbox to do what? And whether you get sufficient support, political support, within NATO member states to make this an efficient and effective toolbox.
Okay.
Well, let me put my historian's hat again and play a destructive role, reminding of various episodes. I think those Russians, including some commentators on this side, were right when they compared the war to the guns of August in 1914. Not that it could bring us back to unhappy days of when World War I started, but reminding us that international relations is a very complex thing, and conflicts break out even when nobody wants them to break out. In this case, we have key ingredients, a small power versus great power, pride, hurt feelings, bad memories on both sides, lack of effective mediation from the international community. The U.S. was caught napping, I agree. So what should we do with that? We need Europeans there, I think. We need European peacemakers, because I agree, Russians lost its credibility whatsoever with the Georgians. That's the question, is how much credibility they have, for instance, with the various people in the Caucasus. That's another matter. I'm not prepared to comment on that. In fact, it's unfortunate because, we have Russia treating its neighbors with increasing hostility and resentment, almost like sometimes thinking they're paying them in kind, but it's an unfortunate, vicious circle. And again, we need some kind of mediation and effort and understanding on the part of Americans and Europeans to deal. It's a difficult neighborhood, clouded by history, littered by truly millions of corpses, unmarked graves. So it's one huge Balkan. So we have to be extremely, extremely sensitive and understanding in dealing with this area.
Thank you. Nick, brief word?
I think that the process still has to continue. I mean, you have two tracks, whether it's Abkhazia and Ossetia or any of these others. One is, how do you keep people from getting killed? And then the second is the longer-term discussion of final status. I mean, it's the same thing that, why is there a European mission in Kosovo, even when the European Union, among its 27 members, can't agree on whether there should be an independent Kosovo or not? I mean, the process is going to continue. I mean, you can see a situation where, it is important to note that states live and die, and independent states give up independence. There's nothing, the fact that Abkhazia and Ossetia have become or have declared their independence, and that's been recognized by Russia, this somehow does not make that eternal. You can see a situation just as Abby's boss came very close to getting Cyprus solved in 2004, where it didn't work, but you could have seen where that could have come back together. So I think the process will have to continue. Finally, just one last thought that came in listening to all of this is that there's also another thing to consider, and you can see these divergent approaches, and it has to do with whether or not what you think Russia's going to end up. I think there's still a thinking in the U.S. that with enough pressure, Russia collapses, or that the regime in Russia changes, and if you have alliances, and you have people on the borders, and you have economic pressure. Senator McCain's famous phrase, if oil was only $10 a barrel again, what would Russia do? I mean, whether you think you're ever going to get $10 a barrel oil again, that's another question. The other, and I think this is what definitely informs the approach of many Europeans, is that there are going to be bumps in the road, but 20 years down the road, Russia will be a European state. It may not be in the EU, but it may have a kind of relationship with the EU that effectively makes it a part of a greater Europe, and that these are bumps on the road. They're regrettable. I mean, I was told last year in Prague that, yes, Russia has a lot of problems, but it's a, what was the line used, that it's a messed up Germany. And that over time, Russia will follow a continental pattern of development, and just it took Germany time to deal with its neighbors, and that, we just continue this process along, and that's where we end up. But you can see the seeds of a very dramatic transatlantic rupture occurring if you have an administration in the U.S. that says more pressure on Russia will lead to some fundamental collapse of Russia, and a European approach that says Russia's destiny lies in Europe, and more or less Russia's on the right track with backsliding and some difficulties, but, you know, to be expected. So
I'm sure we'll have more of these sessions then.
This question.
Well, I think you all agree with me that this has been a most useful, exciting session. I just want to just raise a number of very insightful points have been raised by our panelists. Let me just touch on four briefly, which I think are worth reiterating. I think on U.S.-Russia relations, it's clearly that while the international system has changed from the bipolar one, which it was during the Cold War, that U.S.-Russian relations are clearly characterized by a great deal of mistrust, a great deal of suspicion. But the key here, I think, is to identify the shared, the common interests, and to build upon those interests. I think in that the panelists were very much agreed. The second on NATO, and we heard that NATO, of course, lacks sufficient internal cohesion to meet the challenges of a new assertive Russia, but then also, of course, relating to Article 5, that a growing trend of individual member states to interpret their own obligations under Article 5, no longer the automaticity which Article 5 had during the Cold War period, and that, of course, this greater questioning of Article 5 might actually undermine the relevance of NATO itself. And in this connection, in terms of the change even in the US's relationship with NATO, it no longer has the capacity unilaterally to drive the expansion of NATO. On the EU, we heard from the panelists that the EU lacks a common Russia policy. There are different interests among the European members vis-a-vis Russia, and without a common EU energy policy, and that could be the subject of a whole panel on the economic dimensions of this issue and the energy dimensions, but without a common EU energy policy, EU-Russia relations will remain on balance. On the final point, which I'd like to end, the importance of history and the question of history, which came up, of course, reminded me of the phrase of Winston Churchill's comment that in understanding international events, the further back you look, Churchill said, is the further forward you can see. And Vladislav mentioned a number of times the Balkans, where I spent 4.5 years in the 90s. And of course, that's the graveyard of enthusiasm, the Balkans. But there, of course, the weight of history is so strong, and I was always struck by the fact that in the Balkans you could meet interlocutors who could talk about the Ottoman occupation, communism, and UN peacekeeping in the same sentence with no sense of strain. But I think the key there, at least, is to remember the past, to try and understand it, and not to be held captive by it. And finally, the Hope mentioned the article about the US being caught asleep during the crisis and caught napping. I think it's a tribute to our panelists that none of you was actually caught napping. So should everybody join me in giving them a round of applause to thank you.